personal reflections, and mostly an interest in just knowing what did happen to that work which we did back there in the late 1930s. I would like to comment particularly on a little item in Blewett's rather remarkable thesis on the Curtis Prairie, in fact on both the prairies, which I was just looking at last night. Stayed up too late at night looking at it. But he sort of implied a criticism, he didn't actually say so, in that the Curtis Prairie was planted with a sort of a random pattern of plantings, as contrast to the Green Prairie, which had a planned pattern. And he admitted very justifiably that the Green pattern was definitely superior. But I think it may be worthwhile to note just a little bit about the philosophy at the time. Go back in your history to the early 1930s, the Great Depression from 1932 to 35. And when I came here, in fact, I was got my doctorate degree in 33, right in the middle of the Depression. And what do you do when you get a doctorate degree in the middle of Depression? You look around, pick up whatever job you could. And in the meantime, F.D. Roosevelt had been elected president, and he inherited a Great Depression too. And he started on this conservation idea of doing something to relieve the work shortage and try to get something out of it at the same time. So he instituted the conservation programs, and probably the biggest single impetus in conservation ever in the history of the subject. It hadn't started then. It started with the first Roosevelt, as a matter of fact, getting the ideas across, and very significantly. But as far as the popularization is concerned, for many persons, the development of the conservation programs, and especially the CCC, to use the young boys to develop conservation projects. In the meantime, the biologists had been pointing out that the wildlife had been going down and down and down. Deer, turkey, ducks, geese, you name it. The hunters were complaining. Nothing shoot at anymore. Even the arms companies are complaining that they couldn't sell their shotguns and shells as much as they used to because they couldn't go out and hunt anything anyway. And all these culminated in the idea that if we're going to be involved in our natural biota in any way, we certainly needed to do something about maintaining it, retaining it. And this is the basis, the philosophy behind the whole conservation program. And so you got the Congress to pass the law, provide some money. And the idea was to get out there and just don't sit around talking about it, but do something. What you're supposed to do, you figure that out. Do something. Almost anything would be better than what they'd been doing in the past, which had disastrous results, resulting in the Depression, as a matter of fact. And that was the opportunity which Leopold had been working for. He had had this idea of getting the natural area, of course, Longnecker was the one that wanted a big arboretum as such, a collection of trees. But Leopold, in talking with Longnecker, had said, what we need is not just a row of elms and a row of maples and a row of oaks down there, as the old classical arboreta had been, but present them in a natural collection as they grow naturally, not as they grow very artificially in a garden. And so between them, they came up with this idea of sort of a wildlife area, a natural area, which is not strictly an arboretum at all. In fact, this place should never have been called an arboretum, except they didn't have any other name for it. And actually, the name arboretum, it did have the advantage that these people knew the word, knew what it meant. If you called it something else, they would have said, well, so what? It wouldn't mean anything to them. But it was a respectable word, and so it did have its merit in being something they thought they could understand. I came up here at Leopold's invitation to work on the prairie. Leopold, in taking the natural vegetation areas of the state, said, we have a prairie in the in Wisconsin, in addition to the forests. And as long as we're making a natural area and natural tree plantings, let's put the prairie in there too. And as far as I know, he was the one that got the idea of actually including a prairie in a natural area. And in looking through his pile of journals some night up there, he ran across in the Journal of Ecology an article about the prairie plants, the ecology of prairie plants, which had my name attached to it. It was my doctorate thesis, which I'd done in Illinois. I've been working with such prairie plants as I could find, usually little places along railroad right-of-ways. That's the principal place they could be found, sometimes old cemeteries, sometimes little waste corners. To find out some of the details of these prairie plants, there was no prairie in Illinois. There wasn't a piece of prairie in Illinois as big as this room. And they looked for some, as a matter of fact. They just couldn't find any place. There's more in Wisconsin than there was in Illinois. Illinois is all cornland, farmland. Certainly not prairie land. So I'd done my work just in bits and pieces. But he did find this article of mine, and I was working with the Forest Service at that time. He asked if I could get up here, take care of a prairie development project. I was interested, and eventually that's what happened. I wasn't really familiar with the Wisconsin prairie plants. They're somewhat different from the ones in Illinois, farther north, and a little more, they lay more trees around them. And so I had to sort of feel my way along. I took the advantage of talking with Leopold and with Facet. They were my primary emitters. They knew where the prairies were, and the camp had already been established here on the area, down here below the building. We were said, here's 200 men. We got 10 trucks and some long-handled shovels. You just make a prairie out of that. using whatever you can find, they'd already drawn the map of the area. They didn't have all the land, but they did have this part of it. And said, we're going to put trees all around the edge, and then you this central part and make it into a prairie. Well, that's all I had to do. I had to put men and machines to work right away, not having anything to work with and not knowing exactly what we were to do. But that was the idea. We went out along the Wisconsin River, found little patches of prairie, and as soon as the weather broke, I got here in the middle of the winter, but long about the middle of April, the weather got good enough so to get out. We looked at some of last year's prairie and dug up some and needed to put it in. First thing I found out was a little blue stem, sort of a high rocky knoll. We didn't have any high rocky knolls in the Curtis Prairie area at all. But we did have the highest, driest spot up there, which would probably be the best for it, and so I put them in on that particular spot. As was also said, that initial spring was followed by an extremely hot, dry summer, no rain at all. And they were not only putting in that prairie fence, but they're also putting in a lot of horticultural. They're planting a lot of pine on the Leopold Pine area, and then some horticultural plants over on this other side. And they're getting a lot of those, too. And so most of the crews are actually working on that. And my prairie crew is a rather small crew, maybe 10, 15, 20 men, doing the prairie plants. And it was simply a matter of putting those in on that particular area. We didn't know at that time it was going to be very hot and dry, but the hope that the rains would eventually come, which they never did speak of. But the planting, as a result, was more or less of a flop. Well, some of them survived. I have records of how much did survive, but most of them died off because of just too much heat and sunshine. We tried watering. That was true of the pines and the horticultural plants, as well as the prairie. They didn't have any pumps here, of course. They took a truck down to Lake Wingra and found a spot down next to the edge of the lake, sort of about the eastern end of the lake, put in a chug-chug power pump, gasoline pump in there, and pumped water up into big oil drums on the bed of a stake truck, and got up here, and then had full of buckets to dump the water out onto the plants. And as soon as the barrels are empty, well, they go back and get another. And of course, the roads are very rough, wiggly at the time. jump over the land, the water would slop out all over the place. But we got some of the water onto the plants. Tried to get some of it on the prairie plants too, but the prairie plants were little things here, and we didn't have too much water. The young kids didn't know what the prairie plants were, and they'd walk all over them. It was pretty unsatisfactory. Anyway, they'd actually paid money for some of those trees, especially the horticulturals. Somebody donated the money for that, and they had priority. Prairie plants way down on the list, because those are free except for the labor of getting them. So they didn't get very much water. But so as to protect those plants, they put 2 8-hour shifts from 4 o'clock to noon, and then from noon to 8 o'clock in the evening, then they changed to 3-hour shifts. And 3 8-hour shifts worked 24 hours around the clock, just in carrying water from the lake to put on all the plantings that we had here. And they did that for about 3 weeks. Finally, we got a little bit of a shower. Breathe a sigh of relief. At least we'll last some water that helped things out. So we just suspended the watering for 3 days. Had to go right back to it again. The shower wasn't enough to really help at all. That was the origin of our first plantings. Subsequent to that, we moved with some of the big blue stem, which we got at another place and brought in a little farther in here. And that succeeded much better. We did some the first year, not a great deal. The next year we had things better organized, knew what we were after. We tried sod planting at first, but by that time we could also start some seed planting. The sod was awfully heavy. Truckload, weigh 1.5-2 tons, and occupy a spot maybe as big as this room. But there's a lot of spots out there on the prairie. And even then the spots were 3-4 feet apart. But when we found some seed, then we put this in. And it was something of a tussle to decide what we were going to do with these plants. Were we going to make a very carefully organized garden, or are you going to try to cover area? Now, obviously, Jackson and his money raisers wanted to see something done out here. And we decided to spread the prairie, rather thin perhaps, but at least over as much area as possible. So let's make it look like we were doing something. And so we put in a patch of blue stem here, and then we get some Indian grass over here, and then we get some baptisia, and whatever plants we could, seeds we could get, and get little patches of it here and there. More or less a hit and miss way it just happened to come up. We didn't have any particular plan of what came next, but there we had some available. We got some stipa, among other things. We don't have a carry out there on the Curtis Prairie, they're good for stipa. That's takes a dry, sandy soil for the most part. And we didn't have any sand out there. I picked a spot over on one side where it was dry, and probably the best bet we could put in, I put it in there. But I really didn't expect it to do very much of anything, because I hadn't had the opportunity to select a good place for it. I took Bill out there. A couple of days ago, I said, "There's where we've got the spot of stipa plants here. Let's see if there's any of it left." My original record showed rather poor survival, but I sort of figured about where it showed. I had a map showing where it's supposed to be, and within well 1 minute, we'd found our first stipa plant, and a couple of minutes later, I found two or three others. I had told Bill ahead of time. I hadn't seen any stipa out here on the Curtis Prairie. I looked around for 2 or 3 days, and I hadn't found one plant. But there wasn't any out there. But when we started looking, I hear the stipa plants, and a few minutes later, Bill had to come back and go to work. I went on down and found quite a patch of it there. That's the only one of stipa I've found since. It's not the ideal place for stipa, but it was put in there. And the stipa plant said, "We can do with this," and they're there to this day. They haven't spread much, and they haven't actually taken over. There are a lot of other things in there too, but they're still there. And you can tell just exactly where that planting was, because this is where the stipa is still present in that area. And that's been the success of all the work which I've been doing since, doing what we could with what we had in the time that we had available, without any definite plan, except to cover territory, and to hope that some of them, at least, would find favorable places where they could survive. I suppose I've talked enough here.
Does anyone have any questions for Dr. Sperry?
I started in spring of 36 and had to leave in the spring of 1941, and then I got an invitation from Uncle Sam to join the Army. 5.5 years.
What does stifle look like?
Stifle? Needle grass.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Among other names, has half done names, porcupine grass or something else.
Are there things you planted that you have not been able to find?
Oh, yes. In fact, when I brought them in, I had a little seed, Petalossum candidum, for example. So I'll bet no Petalossum candidum will grow here. It never did. And I don't really have any over on the Green Prairie or not. It might grow there, but it certainly wouldn't grow on our area here. In fact, even the Petalossum purpureum, I didn't think that would grow. I did find half-done plants of it. They survived. It's not a good country for them at all. It's not an area for them. But if I had it, I'd put it in. Hope something would work, at least. And, yes, I suppose, 20% of the various species, no good at all. Nothing.
But that means an 80% success rate, which is pretty
which
good.
Which surprised me.
Considering that you really didn't know what would take and what
we did not know what would take, and we knew that we did not have the areas here that would be suitable for many of the species. We need some lighter soil, we need some sandy soil.
And we didn't own the grady tract at that time.
No, we didn't have the grady tract. And there was an area out there near where your siltation pond is now, which was a hill. And it's marked on the map as a control area. Actually, it wasn't. It was a reserved area. Leopold had the idea we'd go out and bring in some river sand and put 3 feet of sand over that whole hill and make a sand prairie out of it. In the meantime, we got in the grady tract and found the sand over there. So we abandoned that idea, and that's where the limestone has been put on top of that now.
Mm-hmm. Was there much disagreement over objectives between what people like Joel Jackson wanted this place to look like and what the scientists wanted to look like?
I didn't get in on that part of it. Yes, there was something of a disagreement between Leopold and Jackson. Jackson was something of a classicist in his outlook on what herbaria should be like, and hadn't quite got onto the idea of natural areas under natural appearance. But Leopold was very persuasive in his very gentle way in persuading him that this is what was really needed. And Jackson went along with it. As far as I know, there wasn't any outright disagreement at all. Of course, Leopold was very solicitous with Jackson because Jackson was the one who knew how to get the money. And that's what they needed as much as anything. True, the Park Service did provide the labor and men and a certain amount of support money, but not the basic materials money that the Arboretum needed.
Did you do any burning in the early years?
Oh, yes. I was an ornithologist from way back before that. And from the time I first got here, I began keeping track of the birds. And we had a student over at the university named Anderson, who had a few bird traps doing some bird banding. And so I got interested in that and helped him with his bird banding. And then when Anderson left at the end of the first year, I kept on the bird banding for all the time I was here. I banded about 3,000 birds here on the Arboretum. And then we had a wildlife foreman, Bill Feeney, that came in a couple years later. Who is here primarily under Leopold's direction to provide for wildlife management on the area. And Bill Feeney and I worked together quite extensively. Bill Feeney was working especially with pheasants, Bob White, the game species, which Leopold was especially interested in. But I kept track of the others, and we have a joint paper, the Birds Arboretum. You may have a copy of it. That is published in one of the journals.
Ted, what about early experiments here with fire?
A little work had been done with the advantages of fire before I ever got here. Vestal at Illinois, whom had been my major professor, had something of an argument with others. There's some, he calls, saying fire was essential for Perry, and Vestal said, it ain't so. There's some other factors, too. And Vestal pointed out in Illinois where they had prairie which was not burned over. And the driest spots were not prairie. The wetter spots were prairie. And that didn't agree. So they began this argument, which lasted for over 10 years, as to how important the fire was. The result of course, that fire is a very important part of it. But not entire, it's not the whole story. They were of the idea that we should try some of the burning. And I had that in mind while I was doing the planning. But there wasn't much object in burning prairie until you had something to burn. So it took about 3 years before we had enough grass out there and made enough growth so it could actually make a fire worthwhile. And about the last 2 years, we did try to bring some little narrow experimental strips, and sure enough, the liatris and some of the other plants responded beautifully to the fire. And of course, that was as far as it got at that time until after World War II, 1946, and they were able to get back at it again. And Curtis and others began using fire in a big way then, although they didn't do their first general burn until 1951, I think, before they did their first big burn on the prairie. Yes, we had done a little bit and found out it was a tool. Of course, in the meantime, Stan Kane had written his famous report for the Park Service on the fire management and the national parks, and had showed very conclusively from that committee report that fires were essential for wildlife management. And from then on, the use of fire has been a widely accepted tool. But that was done 1950 sometime. I've forgotten when Kane wrote that report. Kane was my undergraduate professor.
Stanley Kane? Was.
Mm-hmm. I took my first botany and ecology under him.
Illinois?
No, he was at the Butler University of Indianapolis in those days. Mm-hmm.
I knew him at Michigan.
Yeah, that was before he went to Michigan. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he went to Michigan from there.
Didn't you find the prairie on the edges pushing forward by itself quite a lot?
Not really. There's a tendency, actually, because of the physical difference, for the forest to push in on the prairie. And the only way the prairie has any advantage is by the fire burning out into the forest.
Clearing the forest.
Yeah. And in a very dry year, when the fires will burn well into the forest, then the prairie can spread. On the moisture years, where there's a tendency for the forest to move in on the prairie. And we have some very good examples of that in Kansas, showing that prairie forest movement back and forth, dry and wet years.
Back and forth, that's interesting.
Mm-hmm. I had the opportunity of working in the Congo in 1952, and the forest prairie, or grassland, border was very sharp there. As a result of the fires. Got some good observations on that.
Ed, were you also involved in the planting of the bog around where it's now being
No.
That's an entirely separate project?
Yes, they were constructing the bog at the time, but none of the planting had been done yet when I was here.
Have you looked at that?
No, I haven't. I was disappointed in the bog area in the eastern point of, eastern end of, beg your pardon, the western end of Lake Wingra, how much has grown up. And nothing like it used to be. I thought it was much better then than it is now.
That's an area that Jim Zimmerman has been very much interested in and has had students working on to try to determine what the reasons are for the gradual disappearance of that area. Of course, several acres of it have been destroyed by the deposition of sand and assorted crud from storm sewers coming down out of under Monroe Street.
Actually, that's been going on for the last 3,000 years.
Well, it's a lot worse since they built houses and
right.
streets over there.
Very much accelerated, you're right.
It comes in a very different way, and it carries with it entirely different kinds of materials.
Yeah, we knew that when I was here.
And we've got, I'm sure you did.
Mm-hmm.
Finally, next fall, we'll start building a catch basin over there.
Are we going to do that over there?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It should help to save the rest, I hope, and the city will pay for it.
Good. Very good.
Well, Wayne?
Do you remember what that far eastern section of the prairie used to look like? I've heard that that's the
eastern part of the Curtis Prairie.
Over there.
If you look on my map, it says experimental nursery, temporary nursery and temporary food plots. That's what it was when I was here. It was all plowed up.
Was there a section over there that was too wet to plow?
The northern part was too wet to plow, yes. But the southern part, when it got up just a little bit, they had that.
Was there some native prairie vegetation down in that lower area?
Yeah, along the edges. There's quite a bit of blue stem and various other species. Quite a little spartanas there, some of it.
These food plots were plots of corn grown for the pheasants and things?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I've got some photographs of that. I didn't know exactly where they were.
Well, they show on that map number 8.
Oh.
They'd put the corn in there to grow corn for the winter feed for deer and pheasants and so forth. And Bill Feeney is awfully discouraged after he got his food plot all fixed up, growing food there. See the pheasants go out down the row and pull up the young corn plants. He shields us to the, right down the line.
What were the remnants? Prairie
species that were here. I'm just trying to remember from the Thousand Ages booklet, was there a prairie rose or some kind of milkweed, or what evidence was there that there was prairie here when you first started? I have a list of those plants which I remember seeing growing up various places in the Curtis area, in the pasture areas. I remember Les Petites is one of the persons I found. But there's a little Lespedeza and a little Baptisia, and then, of course, quite a number of the bluestem and sorghastrum grasses. Some are in Jim, forgotten what else. I listed several of them. I had them down in my record someplace, but should be in my report.
Well, if that's all, some of you may want to stop and talk with Dr. Sperry, but...